rest upon his holster. In his left hand, he was holding a paper sack containing a roll of paper, two hinges, a ball of twine, and a box of bugle-headed nails. Sukyong Sheng was kneeling by the paraffin cans, making some kind of calculation on his fingers. He had placed his parcels beside him on the floor. Shepherd was aware, dimly, that the atmosphere in the store had become very still. From somewhere behind him, someone said, "Is there a problem, sir?" Shepherd did not answer at once. Then he said, "I will take these." He held up the paper sack and waited. After a moment he heard whispering and then tentative footsteps approaching, and then the sack was lifted from his hand. Nearly a minute passed. Sukyong Sheng continued counting. He did not look up. Then the same voice said, almost in a whisper,
"That will be a shilling sixpence, sir."
"Charge it to the jailhouse," Shepherd said. Jupiter's Long Reign, in which Alistair Lauderback, believing his half-brother Crosby Wells to be the half-brother on his mother's side of the blackguard Francis Carver, and believing consequently that Crosby Wells had been in some way complicit in the blackmail under which he, Lauderback, surrendered his beloved bark Godspeed, is perplexed to receive a letter with a Hokitika postmark, the contents of which make clear that his apprehension has been quite false, a revelation that prompts him, after a great deal of solemn contemplation, to write a letter of his own. It would be an exaggeration to say that the renewed correspondence of Mr. Crosby Wells comprised the sole reason for Alistair Lauderback's decision to run for the Westland seat in Parliament. The letter did serve, however, to tip the scales in the district's favour. Lauderback read the letter through 6 times, then, sighing, tossed it onto his desk and lit his pipe. West Canterbury, June 1865. Sir, you will notice from my postmark that I am no longer a resident of the province of Otago, but have upped my sticks, as the saying goes. You most likely have had little cause to venture west of the mountains, so I shall tell you that West Canterbury is a world apart from the grasses of the south. The sunrise over the coastline is a scarlet marvel, and the snowy peaks hold the colour of the sky. The bush is wet and tangled, and the water very white. It is a lonely place, though not quiet, for the birdsong is constant and very pleasant for its constancy. As you may have guessed already, I have put my former life behind me. I am estranged from my wife. I ought to tell you that I concealed much in my correspondence with you, fearing that if you knew the bitter truth, you might think less of me. I shall not trouble you with the details of my escape to this place, for it is a sorry tale, and one that saddens me to recall. I am 2x bitten, 3x shy, which is a less admirable ratio than other men can boast, but suffice to say that I have learned my lesson. Enough upon that subject. Instead, I shall speak about the present and the future. I mean to dig for gold no longer, though West Canterbury is flush with colour, and men are making fortunes every day. No, I will not prospect, and have my fortune stolen once again. Instead, I shall try my hand at the timber trade. I have made a fine acquaintance of a Maori man, Te Rau Tau Whare. This name, in his native tongue, means the 100 House of Years. What poor names we British fellows have compared to these! I fancy it might be a line from a poem. Tau Whare is a noble savage of the first degree, and we are fast becoming friends. I confess it lifts my spirits to be in the companionship of men again. Yours, etc., Crosby Wells. Inherent Dignity, in which Emery Staines pays a call upon Anna Wetherill at the Gridiron Hotel, where he begs her, after some preamble, to narrate her version of Crosby Wells' escape. And Anna, made curious by the urgency and frankness of his appeal, sees no reason not to recount the tale in full. Emery Staines did not recognize the dress that Anna was wearing as one of the 5 that he had been charged to safeguard, pistol in hand, at the Hawthorne Hotel on the afternoon of the 12th of May. It did strike him, when he first appraised her, that the garment fit her rather oddly, It had clearly been tailored for a woman much more buxom than she, but he put the thought aside just as quickly. They greeted one another warmly, but with mutual uncertainty, and after an awkward pause, Anna invited him into the parlour, where they sat down on the straight-backed chairs that faced the hearth.
"Miss Wetherill," said Staines at once, "there's something I would like to ask you, something terribly impertinent, and you must knock me back at once if you don't want to give an answer, if you do not want to indulge me, I should say, for whatever reason at all."
"Oh," said Anna, and then she drew a breath as if to steel herself, and turned her face away.
"What is it?"
said Staines, drawing back. Abruptly she rose from her chair and crossed the room. She stood a moment, breathing deeply, her face turned towards the wall.
"It's stupid," she said thickly. "It's stupid. Don't mind me. I'll be all right in a moment."
Staines had risen also, in astonishment.
"Have I offended you?" he said. "I'm terribly sorry if I have. But what is the matter? Whatever can be the matter?"
Anna wiped her face with her hand.
"It's nothing,"
she said, still without turning.
"It came as a surprise, that's all. But I was stupid to think otherwise. It's not your fault."
"What has come as a surprise?" said Staines. "What's otherwise?"
"Only that you—"
"Yes? Please tell me, so that I can put it right. Please." She composed herself at last and turned.
"You may ask your question,"
she said, managing a smile.
"Are you quite sure you're all right?"
"Quite sure," Anna said.
"Please ask."
"Well, all right," said Staines.
"Here. It's about a man named Crosby Wells."
Anna's expression of misery dissolved into one of shock.
"Crosby Wells?
He is a mutual friend of ours, I think. At least, that is to say, he has my loyalty. I'm under the impression that he also has yours." She did not reply. After squinting at him a moment, she said,
"How do you know him?"
"I can't tell you that exactly," said Staines. "He charged me to keep it a secret, his whereabouts, I mean, and the circumstances of our having met, but he mentioned your name in connection with a gold nugget, and a man named Francis Carver, and a robbery of some kind, and if you don't think me too impertinent, which I am, I know I am, then I should very much like to hear the whole story. I can't say that it's a matter of life or death, because it isn't, and I can't say that very much depends on my knowing, because really nothing at all depends on it, except that I've gone into a kind of partnership with Mr. Carver. I was a fool to do it, I know that now. And I've got the sense, the awful sense, that I was wrong about him, that he's a villain after all."
"Is he here?" she said. "Crosby, is he in Hokitika?"
"I'm afraid I can't tell you."